Hello and welcome to the Library Cafe, a weekly program of table talk with scholars and librarians about books, libraries, and the formation and circulation of knowledge. I'm Thomas Hill. Today I'm delighted to be talking with Peter Drummy, Stephen T. Riley Librarian of the Massachusetts Historical Society in Boston, who has come to Vassar bearing wonderful gifts in the form of letters and other materials loaned from his society's collections for the exhibition entitled My Dearest Friend, Letters of Abigail and John Adams. The exhibition is on view in the Archives and Special Collections Library, located in the main library at Vassar College through April 30th, and Peter delivered this Friday the second of three lectures associated with the exhibition. The lecture was entitled Abigail Adams, Wife, Advisor, and Confidant. Welcome, Peter.
Thank you.
John and Abigail Adams are very much in the public eye these days because of the spotlight thrown on them by David McCullough's biography and also the HBO series. And you had something to do with both?
Well, I worked with David McCullough back in the 1990s when he spent years researching the life of John Adams by reading through his immense correspondence at the Massachusetts Historical Society for the television miniseries. Provided some technical advice, whether the Adamses would have worn wedding rings, what color were the carriages of cannons painted at the time of the Revolution, more narrowly specific questions that come up when you make visual the written word.
Mm-hmm. So you were a technical advisor for
that? And a minor role. And yeah. I'm literally the last person mentioned in the long credit roll at the end of each episode.
Yeah. I want to talk especially about John and Abigail Adams, and from your enthusiastic lecture Friday, I expect you to also, but I also want to talk about historical libraries and museums and why institutions like the Massachusetts Historical Society are important. So I wonder if you could start by talking about the Massachusetts Historical Society and how it came about and how you conceive of its mission.
The Massachusetts Historical Society is an independent research library. It's not a part of the state government of Massachusetts. It's not affiliated with any other organization. It was founded in 1791, right after, within 8 years of the end of the American Revolution, when a group of men came together in Boston, concerned that the history of the Revolution would be lost as the revolutionary generation died away. Mm-hmm. So their idea was their mission statement, a term we'd use today, but what they set out to do is exactly what we do today. Their mission was to collect, preserve, and they said communicate, they meant publish or make available, materials for the study not of the history of Massachusetts alone, but for the history of America. Also, their idea of what history was much more wide-ranging than what we think of formal political and social history today. The Massachusetts Historical Society is a manuscript repository. Mm-hmm. We focus on collecting the personal papers of individuals and families, the letters and diaries that people write, and then we have a whole range of materials to support research on those things. We operate very much like the special collections of the library here at Vassar, and the scale of operation, how we work. We're simply not located within a university library or a college library or at a educational institution, a private nonprofit corporation. There are about 20 large independent research libraries scattered around the United States. Some are devoted to history, some to other subjects. The Folger Shakespeare Library in Washington, D.C., the Newberry Library in Chicago, the Huntington Library just outside of Los Angeles. The largest and most famous, the name is an anomaly, is the New York Public Library. If you go into New York City on 42nd Street, the great public library, the research library of the New York Public Library System, is a nonprofit independent corporation and is a member of the Association of Independent Research Libraries, the Independent Research Library Association, IRLA, that we're also a member of.
And there is a similar institution in New York, in Cooperstown, I think, isn't there?
Well, that is a branch of the New York state government.
Uh-huh.
That is, in different parts of the country, in New York, in New York City, is the New York Historical Society, which is much like the Massachusetts Historical Society. Along the eastern coast of the United States, the early founded states, the original colonies that became the first 13 states. Those tend to have private, nonprofit state historical societies. Then in the central part of the United States, often the state historical society is a branch of the state government operating a museum and operating the archives, the official records of the state. Here in New York, you have both. You have the New York Historical Society, a private nonprofit corporation, a museum and research library in New York City. And you also have the New York has a separate historical agency within its state government that's located, I believe, in Cooperstown.
Yeah, I see. So your institution is, to some extent, it's the Massachusetts Historical Society. It's about Massachusetts, but it's also so a national organization.
Yes, that is. The name is, in some respects, a misnomer because we're a historical society in Massachusetts rather than of Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. Our collections are strongest for the early history of Massachusetts. We have the most material we hold is close at hand. But for the colonial and early national period, our collection really documents all of America, and it's really quite wide-ranging.
So the Adams Papers are a foundational collection for the society?
Yes. The Adams Family Papers are one of the largest, physically largest collections, and certainly the most important single collection owned of the 3,500 collections of personal and family papers we hold. The family, in an interesting way, self-consciously kept their own papers. So the family had a trust where they preserved their family papers, and each generation, I think it was the eldest son who was the trustee responsible for the papers. The family kept the papers at their family home in Quincy, just outside of Boston. But about 1900, when the Massachusetts Historical Society built a new home in the back bay of Boston, a new headquarters building, the Adams family transferred the papers, not the ownership, but the papers to the Historical Society so they'd be a safe place for them. And then 50 years later, in the 1950s, when the family gave their family home to the national government that now runs it as a historic site, a national historic site, then they transferred ownership of the papers to the Historical Society. So up until about 1950, even though there was this vast archive of family papers, the family still controlled them, and access to them was relatively limited. So people like John and Abigail Adams, there had been publications of their writings. They were known. Yeah. But the extraordinary nature of their correspondence was unknown because control was in family hands. From 1950 onwards, and especially the publication of the scholarly edition of John Adams's personal papers and family correspondence, and also with David McCullough's biography that came out in 2001, then the central role John Adams played in the early republic and the central role that Abigail Adams played in his life became much better known.
And you also have papers of Thomas Jefferson?
Yeah, there's another family story. Jefferson, in his retirement at Monticello, was visited by many people who wanted to see the great man of the age. It became kind of part of the equivalent of the European tour was in America, was one of the stops along it was to go to Monticello. In fact, if you go to Monticello today, you can see in the entryway to it, it's all set up with Windsor chairs where people who had come just unannounced to see Jefferson dropped in on him, where they'd be received. A young guy from Massachusetts, and this is in the 18-teens, visited Monticello and came away very impressed with Jefferson, but even more impressed with Jefferson's granddaughter, Ellen Randolph, who was living there, acting as sort of Jefferson's secretary, and the next year returned to Monticello, married this granddaughter, and the Coolidges came back to Massachusetts, and Jefferson died with his finances in disarray, all of his personal property was dispersed, and through the 19th century, the Coolidges in Massachusetts reassembled Jefferson's personal papers. His public papers are at the Library of Congress, but all of his personal papers and architectural drawings reassembled and gave to the Historical Society as a gift this extraordinary collection of Jefferson manuscripts that came just about exactly when the Adams Papers came on deposit. So these two extraordinary collections, including a lot of correspondence with each other, John and Abigail Adams with Thomas Jefferson, in some respects, reunited at the Historical Society.
Yeah, and some of this material you made available on the Society website.
Yes, we're a scholarly research library, so we serve primarily an academic audience, graduate students, faculty members investigating things. But the interest in these documents is much more wide-ranging than what we can serve in our library. So, for instance, if you go to the Massachusetts Historical Society website, you'll see digital facsimiles of all the letters that John and Abigail Adams exchanged with searchable transcriptions, because their handwriting can be difficult.
Yeah.
Also, for Jefferson, digital facsimiles of his architectural drawings.
Yeah, those are quite wonderful.
Manuscripts.
Yeah.
They're very large digital files, so that you can, it's like seeing blow-ups of them.
Yeah.
And one of the things, if you're having trouble with reading manuscripts, if you make it larger, it makes it easier.
Uh-huh.
And it's all backlit, which makes it on your computer screen, which also makes it easy to see.
So John and Abigail might truthfully be called America's first political couple, though I sometimes wonder about Martha.
Well, that's an interesting, if you think about, some people would say George Washington and Martha Washington.
Yeah.
And Martha Washington played an important role, but one thing that makes, just by way of comparison, makes it difficult, Martha Washington pretty much systematically destroyed, after his death, all of her personal correspondence with George Washington. So we the country, has an enormous archive of George Washington's papers, but it's his official correspondence, the largest collection at the Library of Congress. But we know less about the personal Washington, and especially his relationship with Martha Washington. But John and Abigail Adams kept their correspondence, so we have a much clearer idea of how they worked together. I think it's also the case, no diminishing the role of Martha Washington, but John and Abigail Adams had a marriage of equals, really quite maybe unusual now, but certainly extraordinary in the 18th century, which is very different in character than other people at the time. And their correspondence is a real conversation between equally informed people.
Yeah, that's very interesting.
Abigail Adams is extremely interested in public life, doesn't play a deferential role, but serves as her husband's chief political advisor, and was known to be. In fact, the criticism of John Adams by his political opponents, one of the charges against him, one of the attacks on him was that he was too much under the sway of this very strong-willed, independent wife, Abigail Adams. So even in his own lifetime, this was known and understood. And through this correspondence, we can see this much more clearly. Abigail Adams was the better politician of this couple. His chief political advisors, a political wife in the way we think of modern political figures, until her own the time she ran from political office, Joseph Ellis, a historian who teaches at Mount Holyoke College, has said, before there was Eleanor Roosevelt, before there was Hillary Clinton, there was Abigail Adams. And she really should be thought of in the same terms as we think of until Mrs. Clinton ran for office here in New York, and playing the same sort of role we associate with these modern political figures.
The material that you've loaned, Vassar, are really the choicest pieces.
Well, this is deciding which of your children you love the most. So you have 1,200 letters almost to draw upon, and selecting about 20, a little more than 20, because we have other documents as well to show here, but tried to show this conversation through letters where Abigail writes and then John replies, or John writes to her and her reply to him, to show how this marriage and partnership worked. Now, some of it is more difficult. They're separated for 5 years, where he serves in France and the Netherlands during the American Revolution. But certainly when he's in the Continental Congress, and even more so later on when he's in the national government as vice president and president, and she's back in Quincy at their home part of each year, she's with him part of each year and then away, her central role in advising him is apparent in this. And tried to show it by a selection, a really difficult selection from this extraordinary body of material.
Can you tell how in these conversations her ideas influence his or vice versa at all?
Sure. I think that you can see where some of the time she's pointing out to him things that there's really no way for him to move on. Famously, in the spring of 1776, she admonishes him to and the new code of laws that the new government, revolutionary government, will make to remember the ladies, mm-hmm. that this revolution that is being thought of as a political revolution also can be seen as a social revolution as well in this moving forward. Now, there's no practical way in the Continental Congress in the spring of 1776 for him to forward those ideas. Mm-hmm. I think much more you can see that later on when he's in the national government in the early national period, where she serves not only to tell him, for instance, his decision about whether to run for president or mm-hmm. not, very much influenced in his decision. John Adams is not a modern politician in the sense he's dedicated to national service, but he doesn't see his career as being climbing the steps of a ladder, being a vice president and mm-hmm. then rising to be president. He sees that all as service. Abigail Adams sees this progression and sees what will be necessary to do to move forward from the position of vice president mm-hmm. to be elected as president. She also is adept at sort of advising him on who to trust, whose advice to take, that some of his political opponents were not members of the opposition party. John Adams, if he was a member of any party, is a member of the Federalist Party, the party of Washington, George Washington, whereas the opposition party is the Jeffersonian Republicans, the beginnings of the modern-day Democratic Party. But Abigail Adams has the insight that it's not simply his political opponents, but people within his own party that also are his enemies, mm-hmm. don't have his interests at heart. And she's the shrewd observer of the people around Adams. She was his best advisor, and he trusted her advice implicitly. So she was also capable of giving him very bad advice. Mm-hmm. The real blot on John Adams's term as president is the passage during the war emergency at the end of the 18th century, what he called the half war, the undeclared war with revolutionary France, mm-hmm. and during his presidency, there were a series of laws passed, the Alien and Sedition Acts, that would allow the president to expel from the country immigrants, that would allow people, newspaper people who had attacked the presidency or the president himself, to be punished, fined, or jailed. This is a blot on John Adams's political career and is really a blot on American history. These laws run directly in the face of what we understand the First Amendment to be.
The Bill of Rights, yeah.
The Bill of Rights. John Adams, he said in American law, if truth is a defense against the charge of libel, these people could defend mm-hmm. themselves in court. Mm-hmm. But clearly his political opponents were being punished. Mm-hmm. His chief supporter in making the decision to sign these bills was Abigail Adams, mm-hmm. who saw this simply as a matter of political attack on her husband, but more than a personal attack, a matter of political expediency. And John Adams, I think fairly, he still did it. He's still responsible for it. He is the president, but perhaps more uneasy with crossing this line than she was.
Interesting.
In terms of it.
There are passages in the letters where she's very concerned about the education of women and the promotion of this.
We have to be careful not to see her as a modern-day feminist.
Yeah.
I mean, to see her as a person in her own time and not sort of pushing the argument for women's rights further than was logically possible at the time. But one of her central arguments is the concern about education in general in America. She reiterated again and again the importance, if we're looking for the next generation as our leaders, then it's important to educate the people who will be bringing up and nurturing this next generation, not simply boys, the education of boys, but also the education of girls.
Mm-hmm.
Her own life experience informs her. Her father is a minister, a college-educated man with a large personal library. She grew up surrounded by books. She was extraordinarily well-read, but she had no formal education, and she didn't attend a school for a day, as far as we know. And she always felt this limitation of not having any formal education as a real loss. And that's something she thought could be changed,
mm-hmm.
that women's legal rights to own property could be changed. Women's education could be changed. This idea of women having voting rights, I suspect she saw as still far away into the future.
Yeah, and she's also an early abolitionist, you'd have to say.
Yes, she is. And this is interesting because slavery exists everywhere in colonial America, including Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. Her father, wealthy man, owned slaves, but emancipated slaves at the time of his death and his will. But even from her earliest years, Abigail Adams is outspoken in her criticism of slavery. At the beginning of the Revolution, she suspects that the Southern colonies, their effort, revolutionary effort, will be weaker, both because of the system they lived in. Mm-hmm. And after all, at the time of the American Revolution, one-fifth of the population of the United States were slaves.
Uh-huh.
And also, she said that their concern about personal liberty in the South, and where slavery was more substantial, would be limited. They wouldn't be expansive in their idea of personal rights and liberty because they lived in a system that restricted liberty. John Adams felt very much the same way. In fact, as Thomas Jefferson originally wrote the Declaration of Independence, there was a very strong attack in the draft of the Declaration of Independence, and John Adams served on the committee that wrote this, the Declaration of Independence, a very strong attack on the slave trade, which was excised by Congress, the Continental Congress, before it was formally published. Abigail Adams, with this close connection with John Adams, knew what the text had originally read, and when she heard the Declaration of Independence read in Boston in July of 1776. It took about 2 weeks for the news to get to Boston. She wrote to John Adams and said how sorry she was that the manly sentiments, this attack on slavery that had been in the Declaration, had been removed for it. She saw an attack on slavery as very much part of the revolutionary cause. Other people were able to compartmentalize these things and see independence for the colonies where slavery continued to exist. One thing is Massachusetts was the first state in the early national period where slavery ended. John Adams is the principal author of the Massachusetts State Constitution, the state constitution we live in Massachusetts live under today. And the Massachusetts State Constitution had such a strong protection of individual liberty in it that slaves in Massachusetts sued for their freedom in the 1780s under the Massachusetts State Constitution, and slavery came to an end in Massachusetts in the 1780s. 80 years before it disappeared from all of the United States.
Interesting. And Abigail also corresponds with Thomas Jefferson for quite a while.
This is a wonderful correspondence. Abigail Adams and Thomas Jefferson meet in 1784 when Thomas Jefferson is about to go to France to replace Benjamin Franklin there, and Abigail Adams is about to leave to join her husband, who's been for 5 years, has been in Europe. They travel separately, but when they arrive in Paris, they both are besotted by Paris in the 18th century.
Yeah.
Abigail Adams is someone very well-read, is in love with the theater, but it's from reading plays. And there's still enough Puritan hangover in Boston that she has never seen a play performed until she arrives in England and then goes on to France. So this world of culture and music and art and theater all opens up to her. And she and Jefferson are the same age, and they're kindred spirits. They share the same appreciation for these things. They also are in love with the idea of all the material culture of Europe. They're in love with shopping. When the Adamses move on to England, Abigail sends shirts from London to Jefferson in Paris, and he sends her shoes that she's purchased. So they have this wonderful domestic correspondence. Jefferson is a widower with young daughters he's bringing up. Abigail Adams, the mother of four children, is his advisor about bringing up children. So they have this very warm personal connection. There's a three-way correspondence because John Adams and Thomas Jefferson are old colleagues and friends from the Continental Congress and the writing of the Declaration of Independence, and they remain close friends. But the warmth of the correspondence of Abigail Adams and Thomas Jefferson is wonderful. And in a way, it makes their falling out at the end of Adams's presidency, when Jefferson has paid for a tax on Adams in the election of 1800, something that Abigail Adams kind of understood how politics work, mm-hmm. but couldn't see an old friend.
It was a betrayal,
And being hypocritical about it, denying it when he clearly was doing it. So what happens is they have a falling out that they really never recover from, although Jefferson remains unfailingly polite and friendly to her, she's never able to really reconcile that. At the end of their lives, Thomas Jefferson and John Adams, when they're old men, they never see each other again, but from 1812 on, they have a brilliant correspondence with each other that goes on till the time of their deaths.
I wanted to talk a bit about the value of documents, original documents, and exhibitions like the one in Special Collections here at Vassar. And what I find most fascinating about this kind of exhibit is the way it holds up a mirror to all the complexities of a time and place in a way that you really don't get reading straightforward historical narratives. There's something of the time that comes through the...
Well, right. The manuscript document has an intellectual content that's really important. These are primary sources, the direct evidence of history.
Yeah.
Personal papers inform in ways that public, official documents don't. But the document is also an artifact, the object itself. When John Adams writes about once a week, this is the most memorable epoca in the history of mankind, he's enthusiastic about everything. You can read that off the printed page and be informed about it. But when you see that in the rough and ready way of spelling and capitalization of the 18th century, that he's underlined or written entirely in uppercase important words. It looks like German on the page because almost every noun is capitalized. Abigail Adams, being tutored at home, has very rough and ready handwriting that develops over the course of her life.
Interesting.
She also these are people who, in transcribing and publishing documents, there's a tendency to modernize them so that they make it easy for us to read them, to rationalize the spelling and punctuation. What we lose in doing that is we lose glimmers of the way people spoke in the 18th century. Abigail Adams will write, "My particular friend," spelling it P-E-R-T-I.
Yeah.
So we get a glimmer of how she heard things. When she write a word unfamiliar to her, when she hears the Declaration of Independence read, she's hearing it read from, she writes, the balcona of the old state house in Boston, the balcony.
Oh.
Here's this Italian word that she knows but has probably never heard said. She's probably seeing the only balcony just about in Boston, so it's not a word that would easily come. You get the sense of, again, someone who's read a lot, but she is a woman from the countryside in New England in terms of doing it. So there's a value of these physical documents apart from their contents, which means their preservation is sort of doubly important to us.
Well, I want to ask about the way documents like this can demythologize or complicate or put into perspective the kind of history that you'd get in history books.
Well, in using primary sources, what we tend to see, it puts us back into the place people are in.
Mm-hmm.
We get to understand that they weren't omniscient. They were what they could know and understand. It's not on display here at Vassar, but just to give you an example, when there are two old men writing to each other about what's happening in the world, John Adams and Thomas Jefferson, during the Napoleonic Wars, this is in 1815, when Napoleon returns from Elba and overwhelms the restored French royal government, he writes to John Adams celebrating this event, which is surprising because Jefferson saw Napoleon as the kind of emblem of war. And what it is Jefferson is so unhappy with this restored French royalty that anything that displaces it is happy. But he's writing this letter, say, in July or August of 1815, celebrating the return of Napoleon, even though he's this evil figure because of the action he's taken. And then there's a pause in his letter where he has received the belated news that months earlier Napoleon was defeated at the Battle of Waterloo. And so Jefferson says, well, basically forget everything I've said up till now. You know, it's sort of, that's all a moot point. We live in a world of instantaneous communication. No news could travel in the 18th century faster than a person could. So they were limited in what they did. And in their letters and correspondence, we can sympathize with that. The man or woman alone alone who has to make decisions without reference to immediately available information.
Is there something of special value in personal correspondence and historical documentation, do you think?
I think that official records are extremely important. Mm-hmm. The official archives, the formal records of nation, state, person are extremely helpful to us. But it's the personal papers that make people three-dimensional, that give us a sympathy for the individual, understand the psychological makeup, that place people in their own time. In fact, I would argue that that's the centrally important material, that the official record of the career of John Adams and Thomas Jefferson is really important, the public record of it, but we really can't understand that time without having this access to their personal papers. And to go back to my example of Martha Washington sort of cutting us off from her relationship with George Washington, in some respects, George Washington will be more of a two-dimensional figure to us because of that. There's also a weight that comes along with that. Another part, we're talking about letters here today, and they're essential for this, but diaries as well, people's own personal reflections in their lives. John Adams was a wonderful diarist, probably within his family, the supreme diarist, one of the great diaries in American history, is the diary their son, John Quincy Adams, kept from the time he was a little boy, accompanying his father to France in the late 1770s until his death in 1848, a diary kept for 68 years, 15,000 pages of diaries. And there's a person that you really get to see and understand through his own writings, his own inner reflections about himself.
Yeah, it personalizes public
and
events.
And informs about public events, too. You know of a decision he made, but you don't know of that decision tormenting him. John Quincy Adams famously argues before the Supreme Court the case of the Amistad case. That's where fugitive slaves sued for their freedom. They had escaped from slavery in Cuba. And John Quincy Adams, who had argued before the Supreme Court as a young lawyer, who had been appointed to the Supreme Court but never accepted the position, here he finds himself in his 70s as a very mature man taking up a case where not just these men's freedom, these slaves' freedom, their lives were at stake, and wondering if he'll be able to accomplish that. You can read his address, his powerful address before the Supreme Court, the official record, but reading his diary sets that in context, that self-doubt that it reveals. Also his correspondence. Some of his clients, the Amistad slaves, the people who have escaped to freedom here in the United States, write him letters. They've been prisoners here in the United States long enough to learn English, advising him how to represent them.
Oh, that's interesting.
Not to forget evidence that will help in their case. You don't think of them being actors in their own cause, but simply victims who are being defended by this great man.
Oh, that's interesting. So I've heard it said more than once, actually, that denizens of Boston and New England generally value their history more than New Yorkers do. And you can see this especially, and this is where I've heard this from historic preservationists talking, in the realm of the preservation of historic buildings. In New York, even great national monuments like Grand Central Terminal can only be preserved through massive and messy public battles, you know, in that case led by the influential half of another great political couple, Jackie Onassis. And the rule in New York seems to be that anything over 50 years old is overdue to be knocked down to make way for something bigger and better. I'm talking about New York City in particular, of course. But this isn't the case in Boston, is it?
Well, we have a long tradition. The battles you're talking about in New York City that are recent ones were fought in Boston in the middle of the 19th century. Boston lost important historical structures at the time of the Civil War and saved important historical buildings at that time. So the tradition was set very early. There is paradoxically a kind of downside of that. Boston worships its distant past,
not its recent past.
And that's a paradox, that it's easy to make the argument for the importance of the colonial and early national period in Boston. Somewhat more difficult Boston is a much smaller city, but less concerned with the preservation of this wonderful story of Boston in the 19th century, the Athens of America, as we like to call ourselves, the hub of the solar system, as Oliver Wendell Holmes called the Massachusetts State House. That, I mean, we have a state house from the 1790s designed by Charles Bulfinch, and we call the state house that still stands on State Street the old state house. Well, the building from the 1790s therefore becomes the new state house. But we are perhaps too sensitive to that early past. It's also the case, Boston, much like New York City, is a place of tribal politics, factions and immigrant groups against each other. And in some respects, everyone has agreed to preserve the early records of Boston, but not been so good about preserving the modern records of Boston.
With regard to historic preservation and causes like historic preservation, do you see as part of your mission the actual promulgation of local history into wider political discourses, and especially, well, wider political discourses that affect, say, the landscape of Massachusetts, but also that affect people's lives in other ways?
Well, the Massachusetts Historical Society focuses on its role as a manuscript repository collecting historical records, whereas in another state, the State Historical Society would have a range of duties, run a historical museum, if it's a state agency, have oversight of historical structures and the preservation of landscape. In Massachusetts, this work is divided between and among different organizations, but it is the case that we all have to work together. That is, that preserving only the historical records or only historical buildings, or in Boston, unfortunately, we've kept important historical buildings, but they're lost in a modern urban setting. They're literally in the shadows of large modern buildings. Now, this is part of modern sensibility and the construction of modern buildings, but what's being lost here is a sense of the past, an image of the city and before that a town from long ago. We also, especially for this story of the founding of the colonies that have become the United States and the early history of the United States, that we in Massachusetts and in New York and the places along the eastern seaboard, we hold the materials for our national story, not simply our local history story.
Exactly.
So people say, well, why are these documents from the Massachusetts Historical Society displayed at Vassar College? It's because John and Abigail Adams, while we own the papers and we're very proud of them, John and Abigail Adams are part of the national story of the United States, and it's important for us to reach out with those things and make them available through our facsimile, through our website, and by display everywhere. We have good connections here. The scale of our operations are about the same with special collections here. So this was a relatively easy place for something new for us, that is showing things in a separate venue in another state. This was a really good opportunity for us to do that.
So you have a very active sort of outreach education program, don't you, and a publication program.
We do. And because at the time of the founding of the Historical Society, there was no way really to preserve documents. The idea was to preserve their intellectual content by multiplying the copies. You transcribed and published documents so there would be many copies so the contents would survive. So the Historical Society at the time its founding is a publication society, and we remain an active publisher. We're the host of an large-scale editorial projects, but we have an active outreach program in the sense of both public programs, both seminars and public lectures and book signings and exhibitions. Our educational outreach is, in some respects, because we're not a museum, is directed towards the historical education of teachers rather than direct service to students. We have student groups come to the Historical Society. The Massachusetts Historical Society is open to the public without charge, anyone who can make profitable use of our collections. But it is the case where we're doing outreach, we're trying to provide materials for teachers to use in the classroom rather than being the classroom experience under our roof ourselves.
Massachusetts is, and always has been, I think, even in the colonial period, a highly political place. And it certainly appears this way in these letters, the Adams correspondence. When the United States was a revolutionary nation, just in its infancy and in its birth pangs, and people at this time were not only asked to take sides, but they had to understand what was happening as events and circumstances changed from month to month and week to week. And the press played a critical role in this, an important role, and the press was an important part of Massachusetts culture, wasn't
well,
it?
Well, Boston has a newspaper from 1704 on, a continuously published newspaper. By the time of the Revolution, Boston would have had four weekly newspapers with large circulation. One thing that might not have to think about. It's logical when you think about it. New England is settled by religious dissenters from England and from Europe, but people whose religious beliefs made Bible reading central to their religion. Mm-hmm. So by the time of the American Revolution, New England probably had the highest rate of literacy of maybe any place in the world, probably only in Scandinavia where there was the same sort of religious sensibility would it be comparable. This is not simply men. This is men and women learning to read and write, but to read so they could read the Bible. There was a purpose behind this, but it meant that there was a large literate population. I don't want to overstate that. There's some question about whether John Adams' mother could read, for instance. Nevertheless, as a percentage of the population, a very impressive literate population, which means publishing, newspapers to be sure, but publishing in Massachusetts goes back to only about a decade after the formal European settlement. It gets going very quickly in the 17th century. It's long established by the time of the Revolution. So the Revolution, John Adams argued, the Revolution took place in the hearts and minds of people before the actual combat of the Revolution. That the intellectual revolution took place, he would say, between the 1760s and 1774, then followed by the fighting revolution. And that intellectual revolution, that changing people's minds so they're no longer citizens of Great Britain living at a distance, but citizens of something new and separate. That struggle is largely fought out in newspapers and pamphlets. Some books too, but pamphlets, brief pieces, essays on political subjects. And so the reading public becomes essential. It also means that it's broadly democratic. So, for instance, in the spring of 1776, when the colonies move towards declaring independence, each town in Massachusetts is canvassed to vote as a town in a town meeting whether or not to recommend to their legislature and through their legislature to the Continental Congress to move towards independence. So each town is writing in some respects, sometimes it's just a simple vote, 7-4 or 4 against, but often they're writing their own like town declarations of independence. When the Declaration of Independence is declared and published, the news comes to Boston, it's read there, and then the revolutionary government has it reprinted as a broadside, printing on one side of a sheet to be posted or read aloud, circulated to every congregation in every town in Massachusetts, so that the text of the Declaration will be read at the end of church services the next Sunday after receiving it. So there's this broad circulation. There's this idea everybody is concerned in this, and in some respects, everybody's a participant in it. So John and Abigail Adams are the, you know, they're central to this story, but in some respects, they're representative citizens of Massachusetts, New Englanders as well. That's true elsewhere in the country, but it's a different story colony to colony.
So I find it interesting that the Massachusetts Historical Society was founded so early, 1791, and I say this because, you know, the birth of modern history is often situated a bit after 1776 with the French Revolution of 1789, and the notion that National Archives should represent not just the activities of kings and their ministers, but the ordinary citizen as well. And the person who speaks most eloquently is the French historian Jules Michelet, who's writing about the French Revolution in the 19th century. And he talks about actually breathing in the dust of the archives, of the state archives of Paris, and in doing so, breathing in the life of the ordinary merchants and citizens of France. And then his task as a historian is to bring those people back to life and to tell their stories, to serve as a kind of, to speak for the dead in a sense. So, but 1776 is also a revolutionary time, and it's about ordinary people and the dissemination of information. And of course, the emblem for the revolution for school children still, I think, is Paul Revere's ride,
Well, Paul Revere is a perfect example of why the Historical Society was founded, in the sense, founded after the Revolution. Paul Revere's ride, an account of it, is not the first document collected by the Historical Society, but it's emblematic of what the founders set out to do. Mm-hmm. Founded in 1791, a group of 10 men in Boston, collecting and publishing material. Just as you're saying, a popular interest. Their assumption is everyone would be interested in this history of America and the Revolution. So the first publication of the Historical Society was the back page of a weekly newspaper. Each Monday, when newspapers came out, there was a newspaper, the American Apollo, and the back page of it would be an essay or a transcribed document. So they were reaching out to everyone. Mm-hmm. Now with our website, we're only kind of returning to our original purpose. But in 1798, 7 years after the founding of the Historical Society, our recording secretary, or corresponding secretary, the key figure in the founding of the Historical Society, a minister in Boston named Jeremy Belknap, wrote to Paul Revere, wrote to him to the effect of, what did happen at the time of the beginning of the Revolution? Jeremy Belknap, a historian of great merit and someone who had written an early history of New Hampshire, had been a minister in New Hampshire before the Revolution, had come to Boston during the siege of Boston, during the actual fighting of the Revolution, to try to gather material about the beginning of the Revolution. But in this organization he got going, the Massachusetts Historical Society, he writes to Revere and said, what do you recollect about the beginning of the American Revolution? And for the Historical Society, Paul Revere sat down and wrote out a long, detailed, multi-page account of not simply his famous ride, and this ride was not famous until he wrote this account of
it. That's interesting.
But all the details he remembered about the espionage between the Patriot forces and the and the friends of the king, as loyalists were known, in Boston before the Revolution, the different roles different people played, what we know about Paul Revere, the signal system, one if by land and two if by sea, that's all contained in this manuscript written on behalf of the Historical Society. Paul Revere has something of the reputation of a shameless self-promoter, somebody who, but he was sincerely doing this because he had access to this information. The importance of an archive is we have this brilliant letter he writes describing this detailed letter, but we also, because we have his family business papers, we also, in the immediate aftermath of the beginning of the Revolution in April of 1775, Paul Revere drafted a deposition and then copied it out of what had happened. So we have how someone recollects an event immediately after, in the just days or weeks after it, and then through the filter of almost 25 years later, what they recollect about what's important, how history shapes memory and memory shapes history. And this is essentially what the Historical Society is about, preserving these documents where it's possible, preserving multiple documents to let historians look at this and try to, as you were saying about Michelet, try to recreate the story from these historical records. We have this advantage of having a literate society, so there's a broader representation of people in their own words. Nevertheless, we are providing the substance of the work that you're talking about. And this is long before the French start their national archives, right at the time of the French Revolution. The United States National Archives only dates from the 1930s. We're very, very late in getting going in preserving. And also, we're much more narrow as a nation in preserving official records, whereas other countries collect cultural records and personal records as part of their national history. The United States and most of the state governments in the United States have been much more careful to preserve only formal official records. So don't provide, they're wonderful for what they do provide, but don't provide the sort of breadth and depth that a historian is looking for in doing historical research.
And you mentioned, we were talking earlier before the show, that contemporary politicians are often often careful about what they...
The problems archivists face today, there are manyfold, but two of the great dilemmas we face. One is, how do we collect records that have no physical reality, the electronic records, email, that whole range, the telephone messages. That's a great problem for archivists today, librarians and archivists, and then in the future, historians. But also, politicians, no one would keep the sort of diary that John Quincy Adams kept in the 19th yeah. century. They would just assume that it would be used to damage them, subpoenaed and made available to opponents.
Yeah.
But keeping records would damage them. A very able former governor of Massachusetts, someone who ran for a president, Michael Dukakis, told me once that he had told his staff that they should not preserve any record, any paper record, that they wouldn't want seen published in the front page of the newspaper the next day. If you're only keeping records that you're happy to see published in the front page of the newspaper, you're not keeping much records. What you're keeping is formal records, official records, but nothing that tells you really how or why things happened.
So do you collect at the Historical Society contemporary historical documents?
We have no cutoff in what we collect, but it is the case in collecting personal papers, there's a zone of privacy. People are usually concerned about what their parents or grandparents have said about others, family members. They're also, people are surprisingly diffident. It usually takes about two generations for people to see the papers, family papers, of being in, of interest other than family members. So even though there's no cutoff in what we collect, most of what comes to us now dates from, say, the first decades of the 20th century. It's long enough ago that people, living individuals, are no longer concerned about it. And it's long enough ago that people can understand it having historical value other than its interest to the family members. We live in such a mobile society that it means that they aren't, these are no longer things that are necessarily in Massachusetts when they've traveled to California along with the family or been left behind in the attic when the family moves out and the next people to own the house find these things. So it's a wonderful business, but it's a really interesting time to be doing this work because it's becoming complicated. People in public life, if they leave records at all, they're usually so unconcerned with what they leave behind that they give you what they've written the next day. They're because they've simply pre-screened it to sort of create the image that they're interested in having. And that's a misfortune as well.
Do people give you things with a stipulation, do not open until, you know, 25 years?
We want to preserve historical material. So if there's a stipulation that material will not be available for a period of time, as long as it's a fixed period of time and it's within the bounds of what people we can manage, but not open-ended. And it can't be where people retain control over the use of their papers, because that's not fair.
But you have boxes in the basement then, like Indiana Jones is...
Well, it's sort of... No, they're cataloged and right on the shelf.
Oh, are they?
But they're simply closed... Well, they're two things.
I see, closed
to research to say, you know, they're organized and described, but closed to researchers till 2015 or some fixed period. Or often they're open to researchers with the idea that within a period of time, researchers can use them, but to permission to publish them may carry some burden with them. But again, try to do that. If things are not our physical property to make available as we choose or are able to do, and we're in the business of making things available, we always move towards the widest access, then there has to be, the conditions have to not place undue burden on researchers.
So a big question, how does one tell when an object is going to have historical value when you collect it? Since an individual's reputation in history, as we all know, can often rise and fall dramatically over the years.
Our old saw is, let history judge. Don't try to judge the merit of it. Don't try to pick the winners and losers. People's reputation in history rises and falls. The interest of historians rises and falls.
But you can't collect everything.
You can't collect everything. So within the field, we use the term appraisal somewhat differently than how it's used in the wider world. By appraisal in the wider world, you're often setting the value of something, say for insurance reasons or for determining the value of a gift. We're using the term appraisal, archivists and librarians, in terms of the historical or intellectual value of material. And there what you're trying to do is get at materials that are essentially valuable to researchers. There's a formal historical record that should be maintained, but then as much as possible, it should be what gives a full-bodied description It's not the testimonial. It's not the certificate someone puts on the wall of their office. It's their diary and letters that's likely to help. It can be complicated. Over a new generation of historians comes along, and they go back and address things differently. So you want to keep the widest range of materials, and you want to keep within those collections you take in, have the widest range of material within it, keeping in mind that to take everything is to take nothing, because it would be overwhelmed by it in terms of it. But it is the case that we collect forever. I mean, we take an open commitment to collect materials of permanent historical value. So we have to make decisions, careful decisions about what we take in, because we're making a commitment that's open-ended to preserve things. And that work is, it's expensive to maintain an archive, to physically maintain it. It's expensive to operate it. And we're a private nonprofit. We're doing this without charge to researchers. So we have to balance the income that allows us to do this against the expense of doing it.
There's another political couple in the news, Nicolas Sarkozy and his model wife. And at Christie's, an early nude photo of Sarkozy's wife just fetched $91,000. And, you know, a year ago, before they were married, this wouldn't have been a value at all. So it must be, and we're talking about market value here, I guess, not historical value necessarily, but there's a correlation between the two. So it must be very difficult to
here's a good example, and I only know this from values for insurance purposes placed on things. But I think it's reasonable to say that manuscript collecting, personal collectors of historical documents. Many historical documents remain in private hands and are collected and traded and sold at auction. I think it's fair to say that a television miniseries and the publicity surrounding a figure like John Adams means for those documents that are in private hands probably haven't changed in the kind of fashion of a photograph of Carla Bruni, but nevertheless, my guess is that the monetary value of a John Adams document has changed substantially in the last few months, and probably changed very substantially after David McCullough's biography of John Adams appeared back 7 or 8 years ago.
So it seems a happy time to be a rare book librarian to me, as an academic librarian, in that technology seems not to carry with it the anxieties for you that it carries for some of the rest of us. Your objects are often one of a kind, or they carry with them a kind of object value as first editions, etc. And also, digitization in your line of work is looked on not as a replacement for what you do, but as a way of helping to preserve the original documents. Right. So is the Rare Book Archive Manuscripts Library, do you think, a model for the future library in the digital age? You know, that is one where locally based and possibly unique materials are collected so that they can become part of the historical record and made available then digitally.
Right. This is exactly it. I think that the dilemmas faced by librarians in public library setting and broader setting in an academic library within special collections, my guess is the importance of special collections is going to grow. And as you say, we're not talking about the replacement of original documents or books, but simply making facsimiles of them to digital copies. It isn't yet a preservation method in the sense that long-term digital preservation isn't well enough developed yet to sort of serve as a preservation method. Nevertheless, the ability to provide digital copies means original documents aren't handled the way they might have been at once. But I think the real key is something you were getting at, is the ability to have inventories of holdings so that you can tell where like documents exist in a range of libraries. Mm-hmm. This is where modern technology has aided this part of the work of libraries almost more than any other.
Medieval manuscripts,
a medieval manuscripts where it's possible to account for, where there are enormous number of medieval manuscripts. The Massachusetts Historical Society has at least a shelf full of medieval manuscripts, because there was a time, especially in the 19th century, where a medieval manuscript was the touchstone for a personal collection of books. Sometimes it's a token going back to before emigration to America, America, but more often it shows that you're in development of your personal library, you're reaching back to the past, and then your personal library is donated to a historical society and carries that with it. So a sensible medieval historian could, by title, go to a lot of organizations before they'd think, oh, I should go to the Massachusetts Historical Society, founded in 1791, looking for medieval manuscripts. It seems sort of nonsensical. Mm-hmm. But in fact, we're not going to change the course of scholarship in this early period, but we have important things that the world should know about. And by having an inventory of the holdings of all institutions that have these early primary materials, we advance scholarship a great deal. In fact, I'd argue now that special collections, holdings that aren't reported systematically to union catalogs, to online inventories, it's almost as if those materials didn't exist.
Don't exist, yeah.
There's a paradox. It's also possible in using these materials, the digital copies can be extremely helpful. Thomas Jefferson, ever the inventor, had a polygraph, a device where he wrote his letters and then would have an attached arm and make a copy at the same time. And that really never worked very well.
Yeah.
More often than not, when he wrote a letter and sent it out, he would copy it by pressing a thin sheet of wetted paper against his letter right when it was finished, and enough ink would retain in that copy to it'd make a blurry copy, like an old bad photocopy, or if you're really old, an old carbon
mimeograph.
You know, like that, and things that we are of a certain age we're familiar with, but very hard to read. The project to edit, systematically produce a modern scholarly edition of Jefferson's manuscripts is based at Princeton, and the Princeton editors come to the Massachusetts Historical Society on a regular basis to verify their transcriptions against the originals. Now, the last stage in this used to be always reading the transcription against the original document. So it would be basically in the hands of a single reader to make this decision that the word was rather than were, or something. I mean, these be, and even a man with very clear handwriting, these very difficult copies.
Yeah.
Now it turns out a very large digital photograph of that blurry copy, blown up, can be taken back to Princeton, and all the editors together can come
can
to a consensus.
Yeah.
And it's a strange world where the original document is no longer the final authority for what the document says. Nevertheless, it's a use of technology that advances scholarship. Mm-hmm. So there are these sort of just technical, practical uses of it. But much more important is this sort of ability for libraries everywhere. And this is an international enterprise. American studies, the study of American history, is extremely popular now in not just Europe, England and the rest of Europe, but also in Asia. We see many people from Japan and other countries in Asia, especially people from countries that have a colonial past, where they're looking at American history, this comparative colonial development. And there, material available through the internet, of course, is available everywhere, not simply down the street or in the state you're in, but everywhere, that scholars have the same access to reporting of information, and then in some respects, at a more limited level, because it's more difficult to provide facsimiles and transcriptions of manuscripts, the actual holdings of institutions.
Yeah. I see an opportunity here for some kind of concerted effort somewhere along the line to allow people to take their own archives and somehow get them into this system, you know, through historical societies, through public libraries, you know.
The democratization of the preservation of material that we've gone from the Adams paper. The Adams papers, the family kept the papers together for more than a century. Then they were deposited and then given to the historical society. There will come a time when not everything physically comes to a place like the historical society, but people will look to a place like the historical society or the special collections here at Vassar for guidance about what to be sure to preserve, how you might go about preserving it, what materials, early photographs, for example, require special different storage techniques, and then the reporting of holdings so that people investigating the whole range of, you know, human knowledge and enterprise will have access to a much broader body of material than they do today. Now is the best time to be alive if you work doing historical research, maybe ever, but it will be better in the future. Mm-hmm. And in working in a library, some librarians are not so sure that that future is such a bright, interesting place as we do in this small world that I inhabit.
So I want to thank you, Peter, for taking the time to talk with us about Abigail Adams and the Massachusetts Historical Society.
My pleasure.
We've been talking with Peter Drummy, Stephen T. Riley Librarian of the Massachusetts Historical Society, about the exhibition My Dearest Friend, Letters of Abigail and John Adams from the Collections of the Massachusetts Historical Society. Tune in next week when we hope to be talking with James O'Donnell, classical scholar, Georgetown provost, and author of the work Avatars of the Word, From Papyrus to Cyberspace. And don't forget, this Friday, April 25th at 6 p.m. in Taylor Hall, room 102 on the Vassar campus, the historian C. James Taylor, editor-in-chief of the Adams Papers, will be delivering a lecture entitled John and Abigail in Their Own Words, A Relationship in Letters. You're listening to WVKR 91.3 FM Poughkeepsie.